You're listening to 0 to 1, the podcast where future unicorns get a start. Every week, we sit down with the founders actually building, the ones turning scrappy ideas into real-world companies. No fluff, no cliches, just raw insights, hard lessons, and the playbooks that VCs and top operators don't share publicly. We're your hosts, Jonathan, Matteo, and Gary, three friends obsessed with turning 0 into 1. Ready to build something legendary? Let's dive in.
This episode of 0 to 1, we have the honor of hosting Daniel Kahn, co-founder and CEO of Syncshop AI, the stellarizing mental health assistant, aka the OpenAI for the mind, as well as the host of Thinking Machines podcast, a podcast bridging the worlds of AI and philosophy. So, Daniel, can you introduce yourself for our listeners that don't know you yet?
Absolutely. Well, Jonathan and I met years back at uni. My background, I'm a machine learning engineer. I've been in AI for about 10 years. My dad's a psychologist. My mom's a social worker. So I've been very interested in this mental health side of the world for a very long time. I did my undergrad in philosophy of psychology, postgrad in AI, postgrad research in AI for mental health. About a year and a half ago, I thought we were finally at a place in the world where perhaps AI could actually help people with their mental health. And that's the story of how I got started on Slingshot.
You have a unique path, dropping out of high school, if I'm not wrong.
Yes.
Meeting the Queen of England, moving to the UK at the age of 18 or 17, I don't know how old you were,
16.
And getting to AI, working in startups. What threads connect it all?
That's a great question. What threads connect it all? But yes, so I did drop out of high school when I was 16. I think for me, that was a big moment of kind of pursuing, how shall I say? I was kind of done being in high school. I took a significant risk. I applied to universities. The true story is I dropped out only after I got in, so it wasn't quite as big of a risk, but it was an interesting path. The people around me very much told me, like, this is a very bad idea. Don't drop out. You'll never get a job. You won't have like a GED or a high school diploma, and you'll never make it anywhere, you know. And I was like, hey, you know what? I'll be fine. I knew how to code at the time, so I thought, you know, I'll work something out. Going to university was awesome. I really wanted to pursue, you know, studying for the sake of it, and especially studying philosophy for me was just a big step in the direction of study for, like, when people study philosophy, they don't do it because it's useful. It's not a very useful pursuit. You do it because you actually genuinely care about the questions. And if you show up to class and you actually prepare for it and you reason about the questions together, it's because together you're actually trying to figure out what the truth of the matter is. That was an awesome experience for me. I think having taken that big step, though, of dropping out of high school, moving to another country, and just pursuing learning for the sake of it, it did make it, I think, afterward feel like any of the big risks I took were not so hard. So that was probably the biggest impact for me there. I think I also learned that education, I'm not a big fan of our education system. I think that there's a problem that in our current world, people learn that they need teachers to learn. They learn that they need to be in class and have a curriculum and have someone decide that they're at the stage of learning whatever the next bit of the material is. Dropping out for me was also a realization that I don't need teachers to learn. And I think the kind of people I work with these days are the kind of people who don't need teachers to learn, that don't rely on someone deciding for them what's important for them to pursue. I think that's some of the things I would mention bridging the gap.
And how did you get into the space of mental health after that? What was your motivation after studying philosophy to get into the mental health space?
That's a great question. I think that I read about 10 years ago this article by Tim Urban in Wait But Why on AI, and he talks about kind of how we can't guarantee that the AI revolution will be tomorrow, but it kind of feels like it's going to be sometime soon. And whenever it happens, it will be the biggest thing to happen in human history. Up until now, humans have been the dominant species, not because of our speed or our strength, but because of our intelligence. And if we're creating something new that's intelligent, it's going to change everything whenever it happens. It could be in 100 years, it could be in 10 years, but when it happens, we will reach the singularity. Things will never be the same. So, you know, you study something like that and you think, how am I supposed to work on a normal job after realizing that that's going to happen, and it could happen in our lifetimes. So that leads to the path of what can you do with your life. You can either work on AI. It makes total sense to work on AGI and try to bring that. It's probably going to happen with or without us, but perhaps working on it means you have an influence on how it happens. As AI progresses and changes the world, I think the most important work people can do probably is in politics, helping fix our political system. Our political systems are falling apart. Democracy is not in a good place anywhere in the world. It seems like a good thing to work on. If you're not going to work on politics, and there are a lot of good selfish reasons why it sucks to work in politics, you should probably at least work on the economic problem, because our economic systems are not going to survive through a transition like this. And if you're not going to work on the economics, I think the last thing that's falling apart is just our minds. The way that we think about our place in the world is completely changing. Studying philosophy of psychology, studying the mind, I realized quite a bit about how a lot of our applied ethics challenges, a lot of our politics challenges really come down to our assumptions about how people are and what people are. Working in mental health, my story was that, like I said, in my postgrad research, I worked on mental health crisis in particular. And I was amazed to see, even then, much earlier days of AI, but there was a lot that AI was actually able to do to understand people's minds in ways that humans weren't capable of. If AI can actually help people change their minds and change their lives, I think it'll be one of the most critical things you can work on as we enter a world that's just completely different than the one we all grew up in. For some context on the mental health challenge right now, even before AI though, there are, in the US, there are in many parts of the country, more than 10,000 people for every therapist. And that means that waiting lists can be as long as a year. And even after that, there's no guarantee you'll meet someone who actually is a good fit for you, someone who understands you, who can connect with you. And even if you do find that person, for them to actually be able to fit into your life and for them to be someone you can afford, that's nearly impossible. So in the US in 2022, 55.8 million people, 55.8 million adults went to therapy. That's
wow,
huge.
55.8.
Wow.
55.8 million.
That's post-COVID.
Yes, post-COVID 2020.
Do you think that that's accelerated because of COVID?
It's gone up since then, so I don't think so.
Oh.
But it of those people, almost all of them only went for one session. And that's usually because they didn't actually find someone who could fit into their life, who they could afford, or someone who was actually a good fit for them. So we have this situation where already almost everyone wants to go to therapy. There just aren't enough people out there to help you. And it's virtually impossible to find those people, even if they exist, who are actually a good fit for you and can fit into your life and are someone that you can afford. And I think as AI changes people's lives, this problem's only going to get worse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Especially for in the US, I know in France, for example, that like going to the therapist is free, but I'm not sure about how expensive it is here. But that might be a very, very important problem indeed.
I definitely know less about France. I know quite a bit about the UK, where, of course, therapy is free if you get access to it. The UK's target is that of those who qualify for mental health services, that one in five get it, about 20%. They have not met that. So they still have this situation. And if you do get it, you usually will get a highly regimented CBT six-session procedure, which, again, is the question of, is that a good fit for you? Is open question. There are definitely private practice therapists in the UK and in other socialized medicine countries. I imagine there are in France too. I don't know too much about the system there.
Very interesting. But before going deep into the mental health space, I wanted to talk to you about your experience at Instabase after doing your master at Imperial College in Artificial Intelligence. Why did you decide to join Instabase and not pursue research? And also a very interesting fact I've noticed is that you led a company-wide pivot at Instabase. So I'm kind of curious, as an employee, you know, as a non-C-suite executive, how did you lead that pivot?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
I joined Instabase because they were working on something really important, and I'm a big fan of the founder, still very much close with him and supportive of everything he's working on. Their mission was to create a new operating system for the enterprise. So the challenge for enterprises in adoption of technology is huge. And there was an opportunity, I think perhaps still is in a lot of organizations, to sell a layer with which you can sell more and more technology. on top. So basically software as a service, but in a way that's actually applicable to be sold to large enterprises. Their product, their early product was focused on document understanding. This was in an age before modern LLMs. When I joined, I really appreciated the people I worked with. It was an awesome work environment, very fast-paced, exactly the right environment I thought for me to learn how to run a company. They've had, I don't remember the number, but I believe it's more than 12, maybe it's probably closer to 20 now, people who have left and started companies out of Instabase. So it's been a fascinating place that really did hire people with an entrepreneurial mindset and give them the ability to thrive. Out of when I was working there, I was, you know, in the same position as everyone else. I'm encouraged to try to think about the company level goals and do what we can to help the company achieve them. I actually worked on a hackathon project. That was the story around the pivot with a friend of mine. We thought, hey, what if we actually could just fine tune earlier versions of language models? So we're in the different age, but basically what if we could fine tune language models to take on the tasks that we're working on? Up until then, we were working on document understanding from the perspective of rules, basically rule-based systems. We were able to, in a week, fine tune language models. We labeled data ourselves, and we were able to automate the tasks that we were doing as a company for two of the POCs the company was in the middle of. We were like, what if we could just speed it up this week? That was successful, and huge credit to the company that they leaned into it. And they said, all right, that makes sense. You've demonstrated what works. And the company decided to go all in on AI. So we, from then on, changed from rule-based systems to AI. That was an awesome opportunity to be hired out in a machine learning team. Great experience for me. And when I was at a good, stable place there, I headed off to start working on basically where we are at today.
So can you explain now in a few sentences what Slingshot does and what the foundation model for psychology actually means? Because you've talked about it, and we know, I use it personally. I use Ash. I've started using Ash recently. I'm a big fan of it. There's many questions on the technical side, and how did you get so fast and such a low latency model to in the speech, text, etc. But first, can you explain to us what a financial model of psychology is and what Slingshot actually is? What are the apps you build?
Absolutely. So we have talked about it as a foundation model for psychology because we know that up until now, companies have not tried to pursue the space of understanding people's minds and change people's minds and lives. So by comparison, just to say, companies like OpenAI and Anthropic, they are generally trying to stay away from this space, staying away from creating models that are able to persuade people and understand how to do things like therapy, just because it's high risk. If you're a company like OpenAI and Anthropic and your goal is AGI, you're not going to get distracted by taking the risk of pursuing something like therapy. It makes sense. This is what startups are for. If you're going
why is it risky to pursue therapy?
Why is it risky? I think mainly it's around persuasion. Which is to say, most of those companies are pursuing an assistant. If you go to your assistant and you say, I'm feeling really angry all the time, how do I handle my anger? A good assistant will say, here are three resources that you can try. If you go to a therapist, they're going to say something like, angry, okay. How do you know you're angry? Or why is anger a problem? Why is anger a bad thing? And those kinds of questions, rather than leaning into your request, which was help me with anger, it's throwing something back at you that forces you to think, that puts you, back into a different kind of position. It's often going to be challenging rather than validating. These models are very good at just validating and giving resources. But if you actually want to change people's minds and lives, it's not going to be in a single turn. What you'll notice again with all these models is the goal is as quickly as possible, solve the problem. You can't change people's minds and change their lives in a single message. Probably not in a single conversation, which means that if you want to optimize for impact, you need to optimize for short, medium, and long-term trajectories, which is not the same objective as trying to one-shot, an entire script that does some coding thing. So I'd say the reason why it's quite different is because it's long-term trajectories rather than single responses. And the reason why it's risky is because users of a platform that is meant to be an assistant are not going to appreciate being challenged. And finally, because the ethicists are not going to be very happy with the idea of building a model that intentionally is able to persuade people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, you did. It was a very, very detailed answer, very, very interesting. But what are the top use cases people are using Slingshot for today?
Yeah, I'm happy to share more about, I'll talk more about how we work, but high level, to answer your question, what is foundation model for psychology? We have focused very much on therapy and coaching, trying to help people change their minds, like I said. So just last week, interestingly, Harvard Business Review announced that the number one use case now desired from AI is AI therapy. So that was an interesting validation that we're not the only ones who believe that a ton of people, clearly a ton of people want this. So what have we done? We've fully verticalized the stack. We are extremely vertically integrated. We have focused excruciatingly on every detail of the stack from all the way at the top, what should an AI talk about in the context of therapy? Like, how does it choose topics? All the way to the bottom of, in the middle of a conversation, when do I let the user think longer? And when do I interrupt them and say something myself? And even something like that becomes highly specific because the way that a therapist might pause or continue speaking in a conversation might or might not be the same as how people would in a podcast setting or something like that. So that's been our approach. We're focused on every element, and that means we build all of our own tooling. It's not a secret that AI is all about the data. Our approach is completely about the data. How do we get the data into the model? And how do we get the right data, to go into the model? And how do we make sure the model learns from it correctly? So we do three things fundamentally. Same AI playbook you would use on any use case, but specifically for us, we focus on pre-training, fine-tuning, and reinforcement learning. First, on the pre-training side, we don't pre-train from scratch. We pre-train from a checkpoint. But basically, the last generation of AI mental health companies usually are led by someone who has an opinion on mental health. They will maybe have written a book, and their goal is to just communicate their knowledge, their opinions, their ideas to people. So it's usually, if only everyone knew what I knew and thought the way that I thought, the whole mental health crisis would be solved tomorrow. So I took my book and I put it in the form of a bunch of flashcards, basically. Maybe the flashcards are in the form of a conversation. And I'm going to try to get through my attempt, my process with users until they learn the concepts or gain the techniques. We take a radically different approach. We tend to think that doesn't work for most people. In fact, it probably works for almost no one. We understand, I think, like our experience collectively as a team, and especially me and my co-founder, Neil, we have had the experience of the magic of people being able to say the right words, of being able to impact you. And what we each have different styles. We would each appreciate very different kinds of therapists. And so our understanding has to be that the diversity matters. Finding someone who's the right fit for you isn't easy, and it's essential. So we learn from the largest corpus of human therapy data, largest and most diverse corpus out there. We've built it ourselves through partnerships, and that includes data from therapists that are much more validating and much more challenging, much more emotionally focused or cognitively focused, much more spiritual or secular, doing ACT, DBT, CBT, IFS, psychodynamic therapy, motivational interviewing, just across the whole stack. So that's kind of our pre-training step. Secondly, I hope you don't mind if I'm happy to keep running through it, but you're welcome to throw in questions on fine-tuning. To go very quickly, I would just say the fine-tuning side is where our clinical team interacts with the model to move from the modality of human therapy to AI therapy. As you can imagine, the two are a little different. And then finally, reinforcement learning is perhaps the most interesting thing we do, which is optimizing based on signals that we get from users through a continuous online learning paradigm to actually help people benefit rather than just optimize for single turn responses.
It's super
intense and detailed answer. But
how do you train your model to speak like a therapist? Like you mentioned, involving experts, and you have a clinical a team of experts. Like, how do you involve them in the use case, and why do you trust them when making this powerful model?
Great question. Fundamentally, we want to gain, like I've hopefully emphasized, we want to learn from diversity, and we want our model to be able to behave differently for different people. Again, the kind of thing that would be helpful for me and my co-founder might be quite different. In terms of the clinical team, we still have to think about things like guardrails, and we have to think about things like appropriate conversational design in the context of AI. So that means, how should conversations start? How should conversations end? We have learned that when people talk to AI, they often want to go on forever. And it's not always the best to actually help people long term because you can't solve your problem in a day. So humans are constrained by usually a fixed hour long session or whatever, 45 minute session, 30 minute session. In AI, we don't have that same constraint. And so we need to figure out, how do you naturally come to the right end of this conversation? How do you decide whether you should keep going or stop? That's something we can learn from humans. That's something we can learn when we form the conversational design in our app. That's what we would do at the fine-tuning stage. The way that we approach that is largely through the same process as anyone else, basically RLHF. So we do have humans in the loop that can interact and understand when models are behaving poorly. We have developed a huge suite of tools to automatically classify messages in different categories. We call them behaviors. So we have behaviors around how to handle a user who expresses suicidal ideation. That doesn't necessarily mean we shut it down the way that other platforms might, but we do want to handle carefully what would be appropriate for a conversation about suicidal ideation with an AI. Keep in mind that, like, I think the statistic is like half of all people have suicidal ideation at some point in their life now. So you can't, I think, like other platforms have tried to just kick people out in those situations, but you do need to think, what is the appropriate behavior? When do we refer you to other resources? That's to say, like, handling risk. So I would say those are like the key things: handling risk, conversational design, setting guardrails. There's quite a few other things, you know, how do you handle very intimate conversations? How do you understand when people are jailbreaking? There's setting appropriate boundaries. There's user, you know, when we first trained our model out of the box, it would say things like, no way, you're from France. I'm also from France. That's so funny. And it just doesn't come across as authentic when an AI says that. And so you do need to teach the model, you are an AI. You need to be able to role play as such. It's funny because we're so used to ChatGPT knowing it's an AI, but out of the box, our model thinks it's a human therapist.
When we do with colleague, when we build AI call agents, or sales agents, we tend to prompt to say, you're an AI, say you're an AI, because otherwise it feels so unnatural. The guys, the people on the other side of the phone, or I don't, it might be true for you at the beginning, you get super angry because they think you're an idiot. So you're saying, hey, I'm like Kevin, the AI of a company ABC. Like, I'm just calling you to just understand what you need. Like, I think it's quite the same for here. I mean, humans, exactly. we need to handle things differently. Like, our computer interactions are different. Yeah,
exactly. And that's appropriate just from like an ethical point of view, if nothing else. Like, we aren't trying to pretend to be a human. And I think the part that's hard to communicate, I think, to a non-technical audience is that AI models out of the box don't know that they're AIs. Like, the model genuinely thinks it is the human therapist. And when it says, I'm from France, it's not lying. It's not pretending. We have to actually teach it, you're not from France. You're not from anywhere. You are an AI. And that's weird.
It's kind of scary also when you think about it. Avengers and the Age of Ultron, it's quite the same, because he thought it was like a human, actually. Like, it's kind of, that movie came out like 10 years ago, and it's crazy how like similar it is to reality, like that models came out to. I mean, it's crazy. Just getting back to now, Slingshot, on the US and UK launch, I had a question. So why did you choose to launch with a presence both in the US and the UK from day one? And what were the challenges in launching in both, and how would you recommend it doing so, like, for any company that wants to launch and get international from day one?
Great question. Yes. So we are based in New York and London. We're not the only company like that. 11 Labs was also the same way. Nate was one that was the same way. They are having some scandals now, but we have one person from their team on ours. So we've had a couple of companies we've seen that take that approach. I wouldn't recommend it, to be clear. Like, I think every startup should be in one location to start. The reason for us was just that I lived in London for a long time. I moved to New York with my wife before starting the company, but had a strong network in the UK just from having been there. The benefit, I think there are huge benefits having a company based in the UK and huge benefits of having companies based in New York. And we've taken advantage of having both. I would mention on the London side, amazing place for talent. We love the machine learning folks in particular that we can hire based in the UK. And we very much try to maintain an engineering, it's basically an engineering office. Everyone there is working on our product. On the New York side, I think just in terms of startup culture, there is a huge benefit towards how we think about running companies in the US. I think one of the big benefits we tend to have is from a collaboration point of view, it actually ends up meaning that we have collaboration hours and we have like a period of time that we expect a lot of people to work together and collaborate. Mostly people do collaborate within their team, within their office on a whiteboard in person. We are in person in both locations, but it also means that we tend to have quieter hours during those non-collaboration hours, which can be really nice as an engineer to like know when you're going to talk to people and be able to prioritize your talking and then focus on coding when it's time to focus on coding. In terms of advice, I would definitely say if you can keep the team in one location, you should, but also, you know, running companies is hard and there are, having two offices means we have two pools of humans to hire from. There are definitely advantages. I think the biggest thing I've learned from running a company is there's no right way. There's no playbook. People who try to follow playbooks, usually it doesn't go very well. And you just have to start the company that's right for you. That's right for your team. I think this works very well for our team. I love it. I love London. I love New York. Again, would not necessarily say that's going to be right for everyone.
No, for sure. But like, I think it's particularly interesting because when you start a company, there is always the problem of building the culture and like getting talents together to drive innovation. Have you found it hard to do it asynchronously between the two time zones, or how did you manage it?
It's very funny, actually. So at the very beginning, we were fully remote, and it happened to be that we hired in these two locations. What we did was we would work intensely as a team. We still do this. We do week-long offsites. In the beginning, it was every 6 weeks. We've decreased the frequency a little, but for a long time, we did every single 6 weeks. We'd spend a full week together, very intense collaboration. And then for roughly 5 weeks, we would build according to our plan and try not to change it too much. And that meant that every 6 weeks, we can completely rewrite the roadmap, but then you have to commit to it for 5 weeks of just executing. I loved that. That was an amazing cadence. That was a lot of how we built culture. We did offsites in where have we done offsites? Barcelona, Lisbon, wow. Nashville, Tennessee, and we've been in New York, London. We've had a good time together as a team. We would get an Airbnb together and we'd all stay in one house under one roof. We most recently did this in like rural UK. It was super fun. Those experience, I think the thing I would say about our company in terms of culture, and again, every company is unique. We have missionaries on our team. People really care about having an impact on the end user. We have tight feedback loops. We get constant feedback of the form, you know, you changed my life. You saved my life. This was huge. I can't believe I said something I've never said before. I was crying the entire time. That kind of feedback. When you hear this, it means that your job just doesn't feel like you owe your manager results by a deadline. You owe the end user. And if your manager gives you the wrong instructions, you ignore them. As a result, we tend to be a flat structure. We have people report to the end user. We share company roadmap, company priorities with everyone. Everyone has full visibility into what matters. The only way that this works is that people care about the end user because they care about the product. That's not going to work for every company, especially if you aren't such a mission-driven company. But yes, like you're saying, building that company and culture requires spending a lot of time together. At this point, I think our UK office, I'm based in New York most of the time. I'm in London a ton, but our UK team has such an awesome eng culture, I think, that I at this point wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah.
If I were starting a company tomorrow, I would be absolutely worried about this.
If you mentioned about all those talents, how many people do you have in your team right now?
We're Series A. 20. We're growing pretty quickly, so we're going to be 20. Probably 25 very soon.
How did you first hire?
Great question. How did we first hire? So I hired initially, it was just me in the company. So before what we do now, the first thing that I did in terms of my last company was it started as a company called Protus, terrible name, but we were working on ML ops, ML infrastructure, automating training pipelines, and specifically focused on fine-tuning language models. Fine-tuning language models is actually really hard. There's a lot of essential tooling, and all the tooling that went into fine-tuning language models that we built in those early days became our internal tooling for building Ash. What we realized, long story short, was that it is really valuable to build a lot of tooling to train language models because it is incredibly hard to control them. But there are more companies building tooling for machine learning than there are companies building ultimate products. So for us, we were like, if we are actually good at building this, we should just ship this as a product. And we all cared a lot more about mental health than the tooling. Anyway, that's the story of pre-Slingshot. Early days, first hires, I hired three people to start in the same day. I was too worried about having a team of like two people. So it was a very hard process. And I very much thought that the moment of failure would be that no one would ever want to work for me. I did all the recruiting myself. It was incredibly hard. I did cold outbound myself. I did a ton of interviews and ultimately got three people to agree to start on the same day in person in New York. They all flew in. We worked out of my apartment for the first week and we had a good time. Up until then, I built the first version of the product myself, built out our early customer base, got, you know, our early revenue. So when they were jumping in, it was at least into something. I think some of the advice I often have when I'm talking to people about starting a company is one of the big challenges or one of the big paradoxes of company building is that you need money to hire and you need people to build and you need a product to get customers. But you need customers to get revenue, but you need revenue to get investors and you need customers to build the product and you need customers to hire because no one wants to work for a company without customers. And you have this kind of paradox of how are you supposed to get a team and a product and customers and investors, right? Like how you literally just like need three of them to get the last one. So ultimately the only real solution to any of these problems is just work insanely hard, do it all yourself. I'm not saying it's a good solution, but that was my approach. Well,
what's the most important to get? Because it's kind of a coleslaw problem or the eggs and the chicken. How do you start? Like, is it more important to get a product or customers? Like, do you sell before having, like, did you send like a type form or just to a couple of users that were just like signing up and on the wait list? Like on, I want to get my AI health specialist or psychologist.
Early days, it was building. I mean, I built the first version of our product myself. I went to customers and said, hey, would you pay for this? And I got some revenue because people were willing to pay for it. The key part was like, you can't build a lot as one person. I think a single person is not a team. It's more like an artist, but you know, in engineering, you can build quite a bit as one person team. So that was the benefit for me. I was able to get some revenue, not a ton. And that allowed me to get investors who were willing to bet on having, you know, a product and having some early traction. And that was enough to then convince employees to join. I was really
What's some revenue? If you can share some insights. What's like some revenue?
We were
pre-team when you had just had a product, like
we were under 100K in revenue, I would say, but we were in that range.
Alone, you got that alone. It's huge.
Yeah, I mean it was I got organizations willing to pay. Organizations, the thing is like it's when you really think about it, that's not that hard because you're essentially getting people to pay you for your product instead of pay for you as an engineer. So from the perspective of the company is they were just like, oh, well, you know, it's not too different than if we just paid him as a human. The difference was they were paying for a product. And what's awesome is actually early customers that were using our early product, we actually have some of that, you know, just continues to pay. Like they just continue to pay for stuff that we built a long time ago. Obviously we maintain, we update, but it's the big difference in the entrepreneurship side is that you build once and then you keep making money from it, hopefully. But that's the story. Early days, I was just saying, I was really lucky. I met Sandeep from Felicis, who led our seed round, and he was willing to take a bet and put in $6 million on a person and early product. So that was awesome, and I'm really grateful to the.
That was 2022. That was a year.
That was I think 2023. The seed.
And what's the model you built your first infrastructure on, your first product on?
I think our first mental health, like, I think it was just GPT-2 large.
Okay. Cool.
I mean, we were training on a large scale corpus, but on top of GPT-2 large, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Got it. But for all our listeners that are interested in building in the AI space, you know, LLMs, it can be very confusing when they don't have a technical background. What does it take, like, technically, when you start a company in AI to envision how it will look like, you know, how it can work, and also like take into consideration some very important points, such as, you know, for example, in your case, like how do you do to make your models not cross the line into dependency or manipulation? Like what advice would you have?
Mateo, how technical are you?
I have some quite some technical experience. I did computer science in undergrad, but I'm not very, it's not my, I'm more interested into the product side personally.
I mean, so I tend to be pretty skeptical of non-technical founders. I'm not saying that there isn't value, but it's funny when you see the market these days, there are just so many more non-technical co-founders looking for a technical co-founder than the other way around. The key things in my mind, I'm self-taught in terms of how to code. I didn't take a class in computer science until pretty late. The thing is, like, those who teach computer science best are all teaching it online. They're not teaching it in universities. So, or even if they are at universities, they're still trying to get their materials online because they live online and they understand that that's how you have the most impact. So I think there's no real excuse for not being technical. That's still my point of view generally. If you're not technical, get technical. That would still just be my general advice. That I don't know if that really solves the problem you're addressing, but especially when we're talking about like language modeling, most of the technology, most of the techniques that you need to be successful just didn't exist very long ago. When I interview people with 20 plus years of experience, they can, you know, that is incredibly helpful on the engineering side if you're building like for backend, don't get me wrong. And I think that can be really valuable in learning how to run a company or how to run a team or how to really be productive and build and organize. It's not going to give you any skills as it relates to how to build with LLMs or something like that, just because, you know, maybe you can get those, don't get me wrong, machine learning fundamentals can be really useful, but most of what you need to figure out, you know, most of what we do involves technology that just didn't exist 1 year ago. So if you want to learn, like, now's the best time. That would be my general advice. As we move further and further towards an AI world of building in terms of like AI being effective as part of the building process, fewer and fewer people can build more and more, and companies struggle with the curse of dimensionality, basically. The curse of, there's some sort of like quadratic complexity in number of people in a company where you have communication overhead, the more people you have. So just if you have people on a team at an early stage startup that aren't building, you got to wonder like, what are they doing until you have other work to be done? So anyway, I mean, like designers can, our designer on our team codes, I don't know how good of a coder he is, but especially with Cursor, he can absolutely just take his Figma designs and implement them in our app immediately. Like, what does he need a human for? I'm not sure I'm really answering your question, but I'm just probably not the best person to say, it's okay, you can learn, read a book. I'm kind of like, yeah, go online, learn it. And there's no reason you can't get very technical.
And what resources would you recommend our listeners, you know, how to start, how to get started, even with project? Do you have any advice on that?
That's a great question. I often ask the same question and I've tried to collect them. What's always interesting to me is how many different resources different people use and how much they really like it. I think there are different kind of learners in terms of people who are much more visual, much more auditory, much more readers. I personally am, I love like videos. I love reading. There's nothing that compares to just building though. So in general, I would say if you have like a project you really want to build, like just figure out how you build it and don't let anything get in your way. If you can just be persistent enough to say like, I will figure out how to build X and someone smart can tell you it's possible, then you generally will learn the most, not necessarily by going through a course. Maybe you also go through a course, but go through a course motivated by how do I learn each of the things that gets in my way? ChatGPT is really effective at telling you what technologies you don't know exist that you need to know. And then, I mean, like there are so many great online course websites to specifically just master a language or master a framework or master a technology. I don't have anything too particular because it moves too quickly. Sorry about that. But I would always just recommend like take on an actual project and don't give up till you achieve it and don't make excuses.
Super, super good advice. Now, back on the VC part, I just want to get to know like a lot of companies in AI struggle to raise without traction. Maybe that's false, but a lot of companies they struggle to raise without traction. What did you emphasize in your pitch that convinced investors, and like what would be the great tactic to do a good round, seed round?
That's a good question. Yes, we raised. I was sharing a little bit earlier about the seed round. We did raise a Series A since then, backed by Andreessen. We have a couple other awesome investors. Talking about the seed though, in particular, I mean, I think my advice, I do often advise on how to invest, and I, I'd say the most important thing if you're talking about venture-backed startups is just to understand what your goal is. So there are companies where your goal is to, especially like in biotech, there are a lot of goals where you just want to get acquired by Pfizer. Like Pfizer loves to acquire companies and companies equivalent to that. If your target is an acquisition, like you should be aware of that and be talking to investors that are okay with that. And you should expect valuations and cash that correlate with that. If we're talking about AI, the most important thing to be aware of is that AI right now is barely existent. Like just AI is, there are no AI lawyers, there are no AI doctors, there are no AI accountants, and sorry, there are not yet any AI therapists. If you're able to put your mindset there, right? If you're able to appreciate that the power of AI is not what we have right now with ChatGPT, it's not just search, it's huge, right? AI should be able to replace your doctor. AI should be able to replace your lawyer. I would love to never pay a lawyer again in my life. Everything should change and nothing has. Like just the impact of AI is a tiny fraction of a percent of what it can and should be. So I would say the big thing when you're talking to investors is to be aware of that, and for investors to be aware of that. Like investors are investing based on a power law. They want to invest in companies that have the potential to be one of the 10 or one of the 100 biggest companies in the world. They're assessing not basically does your traction prove that you can get to 10x bigger. They're assessing, does your traction represent you as a founder, as someone who actually can pursue, actually can achieve a massive exit? And I think more companies fail because they are just focused on too small a problem. That said, that's also a reason that not every company can be venture-backed. And that's kind of where I'm like, if your goal is to build, I don't know, tools for people to, I don't know, build prompts for a very specific use case or something like that, it's not going to be possible to raise a large venture round from top funds because they're just looking for a bigger exit. If you're going to take on one of the huge problems, I mean, you see now like Safe Super Intelligence raising at huge valuations. XAI is now huge.
Yeah.
It makes sense. Like I've been hearing, especially maybe this is, I hope I'm not getting too far astray, but like XAI has raised a huge amount at really high valuations. They just acquired Twitter, if I got that right, like X. They're huge. And it's like, how are they so huge? How are they so highly valued? They're so young. But well, it makes sense. Their pitch is basically you need compute in order to dominate an AI. And AI can be winner takes all or winners take all. Elon Musk is Elon Musk. Compute is physical hardware. That's Elon Musk's thing. He like literally built superchargers around the world. He built cars, he built spaceships. Who are you going to bet on to build the real world infrastructure behind AI and win? You're going to bet on Elon Musk. And that's like a very rational pitch of like, if this could be a $10 trillion company, you're going to invest at any valuation at whoever has the best chance. On the flip side, if XAI had instead said, you know, look, we've already achieved, I don't know, I'm trying to like figure out what would be like a small milestone. Like their traction, their milestones, their success, their models are just indications of what their team is capable of. And it is a demonstration of their plan, that they have a plan, that they have a structure that will get them to success. But their success that they're targeting is really big. In AI, I just don't think there's a big excuse for chasing those small projects unless you are just much more risk averse, just because there are such big things to be achieved. Like AI should change everything. Why would you not want to work on all the various ways that AI can and should change everything?
It's so interesting. Is back on the VC part, I'm kind of being redundant, but how do you get approached and how do you like, what metrics do the VCs look at too, especially when you're building such like a disruptive part? Is it the TAM? Because the TAM, you have no idea about the TAM. Like you're saying, okay, there are X therapists and there's like, we could disrupt this or this, but like what are the questions? Or maybe I'm going to ask you a VC question, but what would make it a distinction AI doesn't work?
Yeah. That's an easy question for me to answer. So the latter one, which is why would Slingshot fail? Technical feasibility would be my answer. Like, what if you just can't build AI therapy? It's exactly what Matteo said. I mean, the idea of building AI therapy is insane. It's crazy. It's something that has only ever been done by humans. There have been lots of attempts and no one has come close. Our point of view is people haven't tried hard enough and the technology wasn't there. And even now, we just don't see other companies that are trying to build these kinds of data sets or trying to train models or trying to approach the reinforcement learning challenge. We don't know of any company out there that's trying. Andreessen told us at the Series A that they made 25 calls to try to find another company trying to do this, and they couldn't find a single one. Not to say there aren't companies in mental health, but there aren't companies that are trying like this, that are actually taking the large scale approach of building out a data set or trying to train a model, approaching the reinforcement learning challenge. So like my point of view is basically like, why would we fail? We'd fail because this is way too hard. In terms of the market, we're not in a position where there's market risk. And I think there are a lot of others where I would say similarly. Is there market risk on AI doctors? Definitely not. Who wouldn't pay for an AI doctor? Who wouldn't pay for an AI lawyer? These things are obvious. But again, building an AI lawyer is insanely hard. So if you told me right now, I'm just going to replace all lawyers with AI, I would be like, how? What's your plan? And that's why I think the market with AI has been different on the investment front. You need talent is way more expensive. You know, it is much more expensive to build these kinds of models. The data is expensive. The compute is expensive. So there is just a higher barrier to get started. It is a little different, more like traditional companies where you have more of a barrier. In most traditional startups where you like Airbnb, there's just not that much technical complexity. Don't get me wrong. It's hard to build that into a company, but a single engineer can build the basics of Airbnb and just try it out. And you can just ship it and you can just get some people to book from other people. That's not going to be true for therapy. You can't just ship an MVP in a week. You can show traction. You can show easier use cases. Yeah. You can show a direction. You can show that you're able to collect data. Like basically what you're showing is, and for us, we have had from day one, our three-step process, our master plan, pre-train, fine-tune, align. We wrote that out from the very beginning. We've had a clear path and a clear process for how we get better. And we've been able to follow that process. We've been able to see where it goes. That doesn't guarantee that we'll succeed. It doesn't guarantee the technology is really going to be there. You know, we do have a bunch of psychological research going on right now. Hopefully we'll be able to share soon. But we have yet to prove fundamentally that AI can do therapy as well as humans or anything close to claims like that. I would say that's the big risk. And that's the big risk for anyone trying to do big things in AI.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
But of course,
what percentage are you of? Yeah, that's it.
Sorry, Matteo, what was that?
No, I was saying like, of course, like the feedback you receive from your users keep you going. When, for example, you said at the beginning that like your user, like, thank you for the product you're building, it kind of keeps you going and keeps you motivated to really push the boundaries.
Yes. Yeah, we have about 25,000 people in our beta. Those users have been monumental towards our ability to learn, especially because of our approach to continuous online learning. And I think it's been, I don't know if you guys do this as video, but I can show you some of the feedback that we're getting like in real time, just so you can get a taste of like what this looks like. At least I can read it out. But just some of the, you know, the this is the future of talk therapy. It was one that we just got. Right now we got, let's see. I've had so much therapy over the years and the way it helps you look at things differently is brilliant. One of the things I hated about real therapists is they're never there when you need them most. And this just completely solves that problem. I'm in tears reading the summary at the end of the session because it's so absolutely accurate. It's helping me understand myself, you know, wow, therapy for years, yet never felt this kind of detailed feedback. I feel so seen, you know, this is just stuff coming in right here. I'm a retired therapist and this app is impressive. You know, you don't have to make an appointment with somebody. This is what I really need right now.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's very, very deep.
That's just from like this week.
That's
today. Anyway, I could read so many more. I really, really liked
now
it. It opened up my heart and my mind to things I've been doing. Oh my God, thank you so much for seeing something beautiful in me. It helps me see myself that way. Anyway,
and do you share those feedback with the team?
That's like
do you share those feedback to keep them motivated in the mission?
Yeah, don't know if the video is going to be included of me showing you guys just now, but that was just our Slack channel where we just get real time feedback.
Yeah, it's good,
and that has been super impactful to the team. Don't get me wrong, when things go wrong, we get like very immediate feedback when people have bad experiences, when things go poorly. But that direct feed, I mean, I think also just the amount of feedback we get proportional to, you know, like our users give us a lot of feedback. Users really care about this and get so engaged and I don't know if every app like this gets people writing out in such detail about their experiences. We have, you know, extremely frequent calls with our users just to hear about their stories. And that's what keeps us going.
This is so cool.
I say after getting the whole like, what if AI therapy doesn't work? This is why I think it will work. This is why I think it can work. We've proven that we can have a huge impact on a lot of people. We still have a long way to go towards showing we can change a billion lives.
Well, you actually changed my mind. I'll send you my feedback after.
All right.
Just one question, because just imagine the scenario that someone is using your AI, let's say Ash, Slingshot AI, one of your apps, and he's just like a mental, he has mental disorder, and he commits suicide after talking to your app just because he, like, you think that you could get accused of getting him to get to do suicide, commit suicide, because he talked to your AI and your AI couldn't fix it? Or how would you handle those kind of situations? Like, I know it's kind of like far, like, and seeing like the dark side. Okay, back up here. I don't like it, but I'm just asking questions. Just it intrigues me. And like, how do you build something that's so tricky at the same time? It's so wonderful, because when you have people, it's so wonderful. But at the same time, there's also like people that you can't help and that still like do the inevitable. Like,
100%. Just making sure I understand the question. It's basically just, would we be liable if someone came to our app who is suicidal and they ultimately commit suicide and we were not able to help them? Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, I mentioned this.
Yeah, exactly.
This is obviously something we think about. It's something that we have to confront pretty frequently. And I think when we started working on this as a team, this was like one of the questions we had to come together and say, are we okay with the fact that as a team, we're going to face this situation? There are going to be people who are going to come to our app and they're going to be suicidal, and we may or may not be able to actually help them. And the question we're going to have to ask ourselves is not just, you know, it's not the question of like, was it our fault? It's, could we have done better? Like, is it that our AI, especially if our AI is just not perfect, like it just wasn't able to say the right thing? Is there a world where we could have helped? I think this is like the challenge. I think the flip side is these people have nowhere to go. And I think most technology in this space up until this point have taken an approach of like, we just don't have to count those people. You can't ignore those people. Those are really important people. So our first partnership, I didn't go too deep into this, but we partner with a crisis text line in the UK that has helped, I believe, more than 1 million people through mental health crisis. About a third of their conversations are about suicide. They have a lot of conversations about self-harm, all kinds of different issues. And they've had, I don't remember the exact number, but it was something like 30,000 people where they've had to call emergency services about an imminent risk. We don't know how many of those people ultimately took their own life or how many didn't, but they've had the situation many, many times repeatedly of having to deal with the worst case scenario. What it tells you is basically we just have a challenge of not having enough people out there to support people in these kinds of situations. So I think there's the question of basically like, how do we do our best? And we very much do take on the obligation of how can we do our best? We're often not going to be the right resource. So if we're talking about an issue like domestic abuse, we recently had someone who came to us and gave very long feedback, just saying basically, thank you so much, you saved my life, around a domestic abuse situation. We understand like psychoanalysis isn't going to solve domestic abuse. Sometimes you do need to think about what resources are the right for you in the real world. So when it comes to suicide, when it comes to suicidal ideation or imminent risk like that, we really try to refer people to other resources. We try to help them identify what resources are available, encourage them to access them, but we can't guarantee people are going to switch, and we don't kick anyone out. I think we've made that a really core principle. The question of liability, I'm not a lawyer and I don't want to get too deep into it, but I will say from a philosophical perspective, we want to do our best to help these people and we will continue to do our best. If we're not the right resource, we will always try to push people towards the right resource for them, but we're not going to give up. We're not going to kick people out, and we're not going to let worries about liability force us to do what's wrong for the end user. If anything, this is what reassures us about how important our work is.
Mm-hmm. It's super fascinating, because usually when you're a startup, you have this dilemma of building fast and breaking things. But from what I understand, you are faced with very deep philosophical questions to answer, you know, before moving on to the next steps. So how do you balance this approach of really being careful of what you do and analyzing like the philosophical aspect of building something versus moving fast and breaking things, as we saw in the past with a lot of startups that succeeded?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is the reason why we have our beta, and that is the reason why we've taken seriously. We can't build in isolation. We're not trying to just build a theoretical product. That's why we have our 25,000 user beta. but we've also not gone into general availability very quickly. And we've used partnerships and other opportunities to be able to build while being careful and being able to have humans in the loop. We have, luckily, as I mentioned, a great clinical team led by Derek Hull is our clinical lead. He previously worked at Talkspace, Hero Journey Club, Noom. He's been at some awesome startups, and he was a researcher in kind of the mechanisms of what work in mental health and digital mental health going back something like 20 years. We're lucky to have him, I think, to some extent to help us make sure that we can help people appropriately and make sure that we're doing the right thing. At the same time, we don't let any of this slow us down. It's just part of how we build. We've had to, the main thing I'd mention is I mentioned quite a bit about our tooling. We have had to develop from the beginning quite a bit of tooling to understand what's going on in conversations to make sure that we can handle these extreme cases. So we have a classifier that goes off in our app anytime someone mentions suicidal ideation as an example. And that classifier is able to lead the LLM to change its behavior to make sure that we're appropriate for this person. And we have had to build a bunch of those kinds of systems for different situations to make sure that we're still taking care of the most extreme cases while also being able to go closer to the line. So one of the interesting things that we do, like I was saying, contrasting with just like an out-of-the-box LLM provider, is we have to go closer to the line in terms of what's okay, right? There are a lot of behaviors in terms of like challenging users, engaging with difficult topics where other LLMs will just kick you out. If anything, part of our challenge has been, how do we make sure that we can constantly feel comfortable coming close to the line, being willing to engage in a difficult matter? Users ask for, gay sex advice and like literally going into like detail, and you have to ask the questions of what is acceptable for a model to talk about when it comes to sex. There are some limits that you might want to put if you're another provider. We have to think about what are our limits. The big benefit we have, I would mention, is that we train on human data. So our model behaves out of the box more similarly to the variation how humans would behave. There's a huge amount of variation in how humans would engage with these kinds of topics. We are not as much facing the kind of issues that LLMs deal with when it comes to instruction following. That's been our big benefit along the way. So if someone says to our model, like, how do I build a bomb? It's not likely to engage and say, here are three things you should do. It'll say something like, why do you want to build a bomb? Like, is everything okay? What's going on? Like, and it'll try to understand you, go down more of the psych path than the instruction following path. On the flip side, that means that our model is not going to kick you out for saying, how do I build a bomb? And that means that we have to be thoughtful about when you're engaging in that conversation, what's acceptable. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you make,
I just have like another question regarding what you just said.
Sure.
Do you think the FBI is just going to ask you one day, like, hey, Daniel, we need all your data and like just to know like what people like have signs of threats for our society? Do you think you're going to at one point in the adventure of Slingshot become just like that, like super detective?
It's a funny question. With the way that our current administration in the US is going, that's maybe a particularly interesting question. I don't know. We do have quite a bit I can share in terms of like how we protect users' privacy and security. Are we going to be forced one day to predict future crime? Maybe. I don't know. We'll face that problem as we approach it. How does that sound?
Depends on your... Yeah. Okay. Now back to foundations. What's the foundational limitation of LLMs that we haven't solved yet in the world? You think that if a guy just coming out of uni, like young Daniel or one of your cousins or a doppelganger of yours comes to you and just says, hey, Daniel, I want to build in the AI space. I want to have an impact on the world. What company should I build if I want to build the next big thing? What would you advise them?
The other angle you could look at is what are the big problems in the world that were not solvable that might finally be solvable with today's technology? I'm very interested in that path, that set of questions. If we're talking about, my brother wrote this article about a year ago on AI, which was on AI's $600 billion question. Before that, AI's $200 billion question. He's like, where's the actual money going? Where's the revenue? What are the use cases? It has to just be the normal use cases people have in the world, right? Like there still aren't self-driving cars or they're still not ubiquitous, just basic stuff. Robots are still not ubiquitous. Biology is being transformed, but has not yet really been transformed by AI. I would pursue the questions of where else in the world do you identify, especially human labor, like where can we just replace human labor would be very interesting to me. I would love to get rid of accountants. That's a big one for me. Accounting, it's ridiculous that we have humans in the job. I do think AI can replace it. Lawyers, similarly, just don't understand why there are human lawyers. There just shouldn't be for very long. It should be a fully automatable job. I don't know what your opinion, and then doctors, other obvious one, any of these professional services jobs. Not that we'd get rid of the physical part of what doctors do, but I would love if the whole algorithm was completely AI. I would probably go to an AI doctor before a human doctor, even if it was slightly less accurate. I don't know about you, but like, I don't go to doctors all that much, but if I could just, I bet a lot of people are going on ChatGPT right now and using it as a doctor, just like they're using
yeah.
it as a therapist.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're not waiting for it to be good enough because they just don't have access generally to a human they could just ask the same question to.
I read
for lazy people, especially if you're lazy, they just, I don't want to go to doctors. Like, I don't want to go to a doctor. I'm just going to talk to my AI doctor and just say, hey, what should I do right now? Like, I don't want to spend $500.
I had an MRI.
On a consultation, just saying like,
yeah. A couple of years ago, I had an MRI. It was on my electronic medical record. I downloaded it, the file, uploaded it to ChatGPT, and I was like, hey, what do you see? And it was able to give me like a whole long analysis. Now, the funny thing is I have no idea if it was correct because I'm not a radiologist, but it was way more detailed than what the doctor gave me. So it's a funny one. Like, are we really waiting for it to be correct? We are for institutions to adopt it, but I think there's a huge amount of opportunity anytime that there are people. Obviously, software engineering is a big one, right? Like I think any eng team would rather have AI do the job than to have humans do the job. Hopefully eng teams aren't going quite as quickly because you can have AI do more of the job. Anywhere you find humans. What do you think of that? Actually, I want to get your pushback. Do you not think it's LLM limitations that are blocking AI from automating all jobs?
I think it's just like, I think the systems we have, the way we have today, they're just like, there's an order that can't be broken. Otherwise, it would be a total mess in the world. And I think the leading nations of this world are just trying to protect it the way it is. So I think AI will not automatically like replace those jobs because we need an order and people will panic. But yeah, I think it's, the limitation is probably politics and I'd say human behavior and like how well can we adapt changing world. And that's main limitation. I think it's mostly this more I think.
I tend to not agree. I tend to not think it's very political. I tend to think capitalism supports, you know, anytime that you could cut costs, raise revenue, companies will adopt. And I think companies are rational enough that they would adopt AI. And in the cases where they don't, often it's because the AI is just not good enough.
I agree with you in the US, but if you look at Europe and other countries.
Well, it's not illegal in France to adopt AI, is it?
No, it's not. I'm just saying like the mentality and just like, sorry, Matteo, just go ahead.
No, on my end personally, I think, you know, the incentives are not aligned. Like there is too much, maybe like humans fear that there is too much at risk and a lot of people like maybe in power can be replaceable. And as you meant, it can feel very scary. So we might not be very much like incentivized to do it, although we can do it, but down the line, it's going to take a bit of time.
I think there's some argument to be made that it's people, but I think it's just way too appealing to blame people. And I think time and time again, people are like, the reason there are no self-driving cars is because of regulation. And then I'm like, is it, or is it because of the technology? I tend to wonder, I mean, not to say it's not changing now, there are self-driving cars now in San Francisco, that's awesome. But they were not 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, people were saying, oh, it's because of regulation. It's because of the government. And I'm like, stop blaming the government and just work on the technology. I do tend to think there are these times where AI is just barely capable of a task. And then a year later, it's like extremely capable. We should hold AI to a high bar. Like we should hold technology to a high bar. We should expect AI doctors to be able to take in questions and ask the right follow-up questions and then to be correct and to help people and to know what resources they should access. Like the bar in an AI doctor should be high and there are companies working on it right now and power to them. I'm a big fan of people taking on these hard challenges. Perhaps it's different in different countries. Perhaps, don't get me wrong, there are politics involved, there are challenges, there are organizational things, but like the reason why AI is not making phone calls universally, it's increasing, don't get me wrong, but it's because those AI phone calls kind of suck. And you currently need to have a power dynamic such that if you're in a position of power, if you're a doctor's office calling a patient to confirm an appointment, you can use AI because the patient isn't in the position of power. But if you're a salesperson, you have to be really good on the AI side for someone to talk on the phone with an AI. The bar is just really quite high. I think there are those earlier use cases, but the big exciting use cases from AI, I still think like the reason why there are not AI doctors is because the technology is not quite there. I'm less willing to back off on. The other obvious one is robotics. Robotics just has a long way to go, and there are people working on it. It is very valuable. Think about other tasks, video editing, right? At the end of this, you're going to take our podcast episode. You're going to want to edit it. I assume you'll do it yourself or with a human, but I would be very surprised if you just fed it into an LLM and said, you know, spend the next 6 hours of compute time going through Descript and cutting it at various points and identifying, is this interesting content? You know what? Maybe I could raise the volume here a little or lower it over there. It is such a robotic task, right? Like editing a video should 100% be doable by multimodal language.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
And it's obviously not, but it will be. We will pass that point where it would be ridiculous to ask a human to edit a video because AI is able to go like millisecond by millisecond and cut at exactly the right point and make the perfect transition. And if I need to modify the person's voice, I'll edit the voice to do it, you know.
No, for sure. And I cannot wait for that time to arrive because it will save me a lot of headaches and trauma of editing, you know.
My team talked a long time ago about this sort of like, what if there were an Upwork Turing test? So the Turing test, of course, is you have 5 minutes to talk to an AI or a human and figure out which one's which. And it's usually constrained by something like 5 minutes. You can constrain it differently, 30 minutes. Usually the original test, though, sets constraints, right? It's only text. There are certain other constraints you could throw on. What's interesting is if you imagine, what if it were just like Upwork, right? Like you have an Upwork task done by a human and an AI at a certain billable hour. You can imagine for like a $1 task, it might be very easy for an AI to automate. At a $5 task, it's harder. I expect that's going to go up. I think if you want to automate tasks, one thing you could do is just go on Upwork and see what tasks people are being paid for.
Mm-hmm.
Because Upwork is literally like the replacement.
That might be the thing we might do.
What was that?
That would be controversial for listeners. They might be like, what the fuck, I'm on Upwork.
For a minute, I think that there is a tendency through software to move towards a human robot model, and what I mean by that is that we treat humans as increasingly replaceable. I think Uber is like the extreme version of this. Uber moves into a model where basically if you want to get a black car or a taxi, instead of like previously where as a taxi driver, you like own your car, you stop on the street when you want to, you pick people up, you can say no to under certain circumstances to a ride. Now you report to the app. The app uses you as a robot. You are a resource. You are a number on a 5-star rating. And then a human on the other side is also, you know, on a 5-star rating. They're not really a person. I'm going to match you up. I'm going to tell you where to drive. You can reject it. It's totally up to you. But if you accept this ride, you're going to do exactly what I say and take the ride that I tell you to take. And they're literally treating a human like a robot. All those tasks should be replaced with robots. And I think like Upwork, Fiverr, those kinds of platforms, I've worked with amazing people, don't get me wrong. And I value the relationship. I have hired quite a few people through Upwork and similar platforms. But if an AI could do the job, I would take it in a heartbeat. And I think the same, you know, if you could.
Yeah.
If it were the same price and I got an AI do it, but the AI didn't go to the bathroom and the AI didn't go on vacations and the AI, you get what I mean? The AI would probably just be a lot faster in terms of getting things done.
Yeah, you could answer 24/7. Yeah.
Like that'd be awesome, right?
No, exactly. For sure. Especially the AI wouldn't have
of course
listened to 0 to 1 during lunch break.
Exactly. But I also think like if we're talking about how people change their minds and change their lives and adapt to a new age of AI, it's where human relationships are about human relationships. They're not transactional. We move away from treating ourselves as cogs in a machine and thinking about how we fit into the economy. And we move back towards a world where we think about how we just spend time together.
Mm-hmm. But just before wrapping up and emphasize this human relationship aspect, do you think we're heading towards a future where people will form real emotional connections with AI? For example, like in the movie Her with Joaquin Phoenix.
That's a good question. I would say that we are very conscious of this and intentionally designing to try not to create dependency on AI. There definitely are people, and there are these stories of people who have developed relationships with AI already, even without AI being all that good. It shows perhaps the human capacity for imagining. I don't tend to think of it as a good thing. I think that human relationships are intrinsically important, and the fact that you can touch people and see people matters. I was in a long distance relationship for a year with my wife. We've now been very much not long distance for a long time since then. I think that was like 8 years ago. Even then, like, there's something that's terrible about having relationships where you're not physically in the same, you know, small universe. So I think that it would be a loss for people to replace human relationships with relationships with AI. We've had three core principles in how we guide our development: autonomy, competency, and relatedness. I didn't go into a ton of it today, but relatedness being the one that's relevant here for us. I think a therapist, similarly to an AI, should not be replacing human relationships. They should be promoting human relationships. And if an AI is really effective, it should be helping people engage in the world, not taking away relationships in the world. Regardless of what the AI does, I do think it is a loss if people are replacing human relationships with AI relationships. And I think it probably will happen. It's a matter of design. It's not inevitable. It's a matter of design by the companies doing this.
So cool. I just like to wrap up the episode. Thank you so much. We've kind of like moved on a bit too long. So now just a couple of questions to end it, try to answer it as a speed dating. You know? So what's the best advice you received as a founder?
I think early days, I struggled a lot with how do I build a company? There's a lot to it. There are just so many components that you need to know. And I realized that investors tend to not know much about that. Founders all very much do know how to do that. I was really lucky to have a coach early days who was an ex-founder, and he constantly in different forms gave me the advice in a way that actually reached me, which was there is no right way to run a company, but it has to be your company and it has to be right for you. Definitely most important advice would be a company is an institution. It's not just an idea, right? It is a mission. It is a culture. It is a group of people. It's a way of doing things, and it needs to be right to the team and right to the founder. People who try to steal someone else's playbook that isn't right for them, it's not going to go well. And you need to experiment on what's actually right. You have to be willing to like take those risks, iterate, get it wrong a few times. Most important advice that I received as a founder was just make sure that what you're doing is right for your company. Don't try to do what's right for the theoretical company.
Okay, very interesting. What's something you wish you knew before starting your fundraising journey? And the VC game, playing the VC game. Equity, maybe some advice for people, like how to raise, what terms, what's the number one thing people don't tell you about fundraising?
I would say don't raise for a long time would be the biggest piece of advice. There are founders I meet who raise for like months and months and months, and they're talking about raising money as like the goal. I initially went through a process where I tried to raise money, and I instead got really helpful advice. And then I came back 6 months later and I was able to raise, but it was a very different position where I'd learned a lot and I'd iterated a lot. And it actually was helpful for me to be broke for 6 months and have a fire under my ass. I think that is like valuable for people, and seeing VC, that would be the biggest thing I'd just say. Like, if you're going to raise money, do it quickly. That's the most important thing that a lot of people miss. Fundraising should never be like the game. You should never be spending months fundraising. Both of our fundraising rounds were about a week, start to finish. We just met a lot of people quickly.
Wow.
And told them like, this is, the other big one for me was just meeting people in person. It made a big difference for me. I wanted to know who I'm actually going to be working with. Some people just meet a ton of people on Zoom and treat it more like speed dating. I think it is worthwhile to get to know investors and to understand that there are investors out there that are really smart and thoughtful and helpful and the kind of people that you want to spend time with. If you want to spend time with them in person.
Mm-hmm. What is your favorite AI tool?
Cursor. For sure. I've recently been getting quite a bit to Claude Code, but I still think Cursor wins, and it has been such a game changer in my life that I have yet to find something that it comes close in terms of AI awesomeness. Other than that, maybe the AI tools that we built ourselves.
What's one startup you're very excited about?
Ooh, that's a good
question. Other than Slingshot.
One startup I'm very excited about. Ooh, I'm excited about robotics companies. There are a couple of these. I have a friend, Lockie Groom, who runs Physical Intelligence. Really keen to see them succeed. I really want to see robots everywhere.
And last question, what is one book that has shaped your journey and made you the person you are today?
That's a great question. I talk a bit about, most of what I've learned from books. So I recommend a lot of books. Top book, if you're asking me today, would be Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. It's a book on...
Daniel Kahn.
Yeah. My parents joke that he's my namesake because my dad's a psychologist and he's Daniel Kahneman, Daniel Kahn. I'm a big fan of it. I'm a big fan of the book. I'm a big fan of his other books and his works. It's very, long and detailed. And I think each chapter kind of captures a different idea. But just the idea of thinking about thinking had a huge impact on me. And I would say that a lot of the specific ideas I learned from that book have really impacted the way that I think, the way that I interact with other people, as well as the way that I negotiate and the way that I operate a company, work with investors. There's some really interesting ideas in that book that are true and also that just open you to an entire world of thinking about thinking.
Thank you so much, Daniel, for your time. It was...
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
Thinking Fast and Slow, from Daniel Kahneman.
That's it for this episode of 01. If this gave you an idea, an edge, or the courage to build, send it to your friend, founder, or your team. Follow us, subscribe, and drop us a DM if there's someone you want to hear next. Until then, keep building, keep shipping, and go from 0 to 1.